From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center.
Our Constitution was meant to internalize all political ambitions under an enduring constitutional form, so that never again would anyone have to pursue political ambition or power by overturning the Constitution. It is a final constitution in that respect.
Welcome to Soundings. 200 years ago this month, 55 constitutional delegates gathered in Philadelphia to debate what was to become America's principal governing document. At that time, the Constitution was based on 23 fundamental resolutions drawn up by a five-man committee earlier in the summer of 1787. One of the central issues facing the Constitutional Convention was the definition of federalism for the new nation. The development of American federalism is the topic on the following edition of Soundings. My guest is William Allen of Harvey Mudd College. William Allen appears on Soundings through the Tocqueville Forum, a public policy lecture series sponsored by Wake Forest University in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Bill Allen, you come to Soundings by way of WFDD, the public radio station in Winston-Salem, and we're grateful for this opportunity to talk to you. You are an expert on the Constitution, and you're going to tell us today about the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists. Talk to me in general terms and set the stage for me. What did the word Federalist mean to the men and women, I take it principally men, who were involved in setting up the United States of America a couple of hundred years ago?
Well, that's certainly correct. The term had meaning, though, for men and women in general, because it didn't merely grow out of the Constitutional Convention or the ratification debate. The term we use today, federalism, we get from our Constitution and our federal structure. Mm-hmm. And it has a slightly different meaning, therefore, than what it had originally.
Was it a good word or a bad word? Help me to understand how people might have used it.
Depends on where
days.
You stood, Wayne.
Sure.
What people usually don't realize is that before the Constitutional Convention, while the Articles of Confederation were still in force, and while the politics of the Confederation and the states were hot and heavy, people were called unfederal or federal, depending on whether they were attached to the Congress of the Confederation or attached to the state-level governments. You would often find men like George Washington in their correspondence referring to some of their political opponents as men of unfederal sentiments. That's the milieu out of which the term anti-federalism grew.
Did the federal government see itself as, how powerful was it? What were the perils and the rewards of being federal or anti-federal? Help me with that.
Well, prior to the Constitution, again, under the Articles of Confederation, the question of power was a tricky question because on paper, the Congress was immensely powerful. It simply didn't have the enforcement powers that went along with the legislative powers that had been assigned to it, so that if it wanted to raise taxes to pay off the debt of the United States, it could pass a general law.
It could talk, but it couldn't act.
It could talk at great length,
yeah.
But it had to beg the states to put up the money to actually tax the citizens and then pass it on to the Congress. So its powers were divided powers.
Uh-huh.
They were great, but they were not complete.
Help me to understand how we evolved into a Republican Confederation, have we resolved this issue? Certainly we have debate about this today, but again, let's keep it back a couple of hundred years ago.
Sure.
and get me over that bump of the Federalists versus the Anti-Federalists.
Well, but you know, going back 100 years in a way requires starting from where we are.
Fair enough.
Because it seems to me that you've got to say, yes, of course we've resolved it. We all know what it means to be Republican, and we all know what we mean by the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
And the resolutions from 200 years ago show up in what we take these things to mean today. So that if you ask yourself the question, it seems to me, how did the Americans at the time of the founding settle on the notion of republicanism? The answer will be the very same sort of answer you would give today, out of a jealousy of power,
mm-hmm.
out of a concern for liberty, out of a concern foremost to make certain that there would not be created on this continent what had existed everywhere else throughout human history, mm-hmm. namely an all-powerful government over which the people did not have ultimate control.
Key that, Bill Allen, to a couple of specific issues. For example, tell me about the traffic among and between the states, the regulation of commerce.
Let's take that as a good example. I'll use both of them ultimately, I suppose, but look at the practical problem first of having wars between states like New York, New Jersey, Delaware, and Connecticut, and others dealing with questions of commerce, mm-hmm. raising tariff barriers against one another. These things had begun to happen under the Articles of Confederation.
Separate nations, practically.
They were, in fact, operating as separate nations. Mm-hmm. They were making independent judgments about the degree to which they would participate in the general government, the Congress. At a certain point, you have to realize that that won't work and sustain the edifice which they had originally set out to accomplish. Mm-hmm. You know, Abraham Lincoln always counted the date of American Union from 1774.
Why is that?
And that's when the Congress called the Suffolk Resolve Congress, the first Continental Congress, met and declared its principles. It didn't declare independence, but it was clear its principles meant independence and meant ultimately an American Union. And it is true if you look at people like Benjamin Rush in Pennsylvania in 1787, when he says, "Come forward, patriots, the revolution is not over." Uh-huh. And he goes back to 1774, and he goes by way of the Declaration of Independence in 1776. All of them seem to have meant by this claim that the real thrust of the American founding was to produce a continental union and a solid government to eliminate problems like tariff barriers between the states, like the what was called in that day the privileges and immunities of citizenship as one moved from state to state, mm-hmm. putting people on what was generally an equal footing before the law.
Help me again. Be specific and tell me how we got around this this bump in the road of commerce among and between
the states. Well, we got around it very practically. Look at how the articles were first ratified. They were proposed in 1777, sent out to the states. They were not ratified until 1781, in spite of urgent necessity, in spite of a war going on that had to be resolved. What held it up in the last analysis was the insistence by the state of Maryland, among others, but particularly Maryland, that there was a lot of property held in the West that, as they went into the Union, was held by individual states. And that seemed inappropriate. If we were going to form a union, that ought to become general public property. Mm-hmm. So it was those kinds of questions that had to be resolved. That was the bump in the road that had to be gotten over. Look at it from the negative side for a moment. Following the war, there were immense debts owed not only to foreign nations, but to those who shed their blood for this country. How were those debts to be paid? To be paid by the Americans as a people, mm-hmm. who were commonly engaged in this, or somehow apportioned out separately to the states? Getting over that bump in the road meant moving in the direction of producing ultimately a nation. You know, George Washington, at the conclusion of the war, after the essentially the signing of the peace treaty, sent out a message to all the 13 states. This is just before he leaves the army and resigns back to his, returns to his farm at Mount Vernon. Sends a message and he says to them in this circular address to the governors of the 13 states, that we face a crisis, that we either will make this a true nation, one people, which is a free nation, which is Republican, or we will fail and return to the old ways the world has always known. So while we talk about the practical problems, and men like Richard Henry Lee in Virginia, who were somewhat suspicious of the Continental Congress and wanted to protect the privileges of the states, really what we're talking about is whether we're going to make this daring experiment to produce free Republican government on a large scale, mm-hmm. or whether we're going to live in the way Europe had lived and other parts of the world in petty independent states, which sooner or later would end up fighting their own wars with one another and looking just the way the world had always looked.
Mm-hmm. Bill Allen, what about the Anti-Federalists?
The Anti-Federalists, once the Constitution had been drafted and mm-hmm. proposed for ratification, became a differing thing than they had been prior to the Constitutional Convention. Before, it was only a question of the tension between state and central politics. Now, it was a question of what is this nation going to be like? One historian, Cecilia Kenyon, has called the Anti-Federalists men of little faith. Now, what she meant by that was that they didn't have faith in these new ideas of representation and republicanism on a broad scale.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a mistake to think of them as un-American. It's also a mistake, I think, to think that they were opposed to union, that they hadn't thought through, as far as some others had, what the conditions of union would be. All they had arrived at different conclusions, and they thought it wouldn't work on a large scale.
When you say that they were men of little faith, or their critics accused them of being men of little faith, were they talking about what? Political faith? Faith in human nature? Faith in specific kinds of political goals? Tease that out for
me. Yes. What is meant, seems to me, as I understand these things, is that they did not have much faith in the possibility of pulling together from a large society a principle of representation that would still preserve the predominant influence of the people, that would mirror the people in the representation, that would faithfully reflect the diverse interests of the society, that would protect the what they regarded as precious, that base in the middle class of the country, so that the tone of the country would continue to be set essentially by that middle class.
Well, isn't it a bit of an irony then, Bill Allen, that if the Anti-Federalists were speaking for what you have just described as the middle class would triumph and after a fashion end up running this country. Have I got that right?
Yes, you have it quite correct. And the reason, of course, is that the Federalists argued that that would occur in just that way.
And they were what, just lucky that it did?
No, I think it has happened that way partly by design and partly by luck. Look, James Madison feared throughout his whole life that it wouldn't turn out. Let's say there were no sure bets in this game.
Sure.
Okay? One of the most interesting stories in my own mind is the story of Madison, who sits down some 40 years after the convention and starts rewriting. He doesn't change the records of the convention, but on a different memorandum. He thinks through again his contributions to the debate on the day of August 7th and writes it out all over again. On that day, he was arguing about what the future might look like in terms of suffrage and the relationship of the classes and whether there would be a large enough middle class to sustain itself over against the mass of unpropertied that would emerge with a growing commercial and industrial society.
Right.
This plagued him even in the last years of his life, still almost 20 years later. So there were no sure bets, but the Anti-Federalists thought at least if you kept good control in the states, kept it small enough, then you can guard against what they often call aristocratic pretensions and such things. Well, Madison wasn't afraid of aristocratic pretensions. He was more afraid that you were going to develop a society with sharp divisions between haves and have-nots. The have-nots would become very numerous, and given the acceptance of principles of universal suffrage, and he generally had to accept that in the end, that you would then lose everything.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so that it worked, that the middle class is running it, in a sense, satisfies the ambitions both of Federalists and Anti-Federalists. And we have been able to resolve in practice what they could not resolve in debate in 1787-88.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You're listening to a discussion about American federalism and the bicentennial of the Constitution of the United States. My guest is William Allen, a professor of political science at Harvey Mudd College. William Allen appears on Soundings courtesy of the Tocqueville Forum, a public policy lecture series sponsored by Wake Forest University in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. 200 years ago in Philadelphia, 55 delegates debated the proposed Constitution of the United States. Those in favor were Federalists. Those against were Anti-Federalists. The Federalists prevailed, yet according to William Allen, it's inaccurate to overlook the contribution of Anti-Federalist theory to the evolution of American political thought.
Bill Allen, let's move to the the other side of the spectrum. If we have these large
Anti-Federalists.
Well, no, not so much that. If we have these large prominent figures, Hamilton, Madison, Washington, who were our moral contexts and inspirations,
yes.
Tell me about ordinary people. What was the? How did they talk back and forth about the Constitutional Convention and the debate? Was it as lively among the populace as it was amongst this group of 55 people who were setting us up, as it were?
You know, there was an anonymous pamphlet published in Massachusetts towards the end of the convention. It hadn't yet closed. We don't know who wrote it. It seems to have been just an ordinary citizen. And in it, he says, in effect, take your time, wise founders. Argue about your Lockes, your Montesquieus, your Bolingbrokes, and your Humes, but never forget that never did so much depend on the quality of the material you're working with. Now, the material they were working with was the people.
Right.
The ordinary people. It was amazing to me to go back and read, to see how caught up in this through the newspaper discussions ordinary people, as we call them today, were. They were not a world apart, a life separate and different. They were seeing played out their own aspirations and hopes, and they were very much involved in it.
Would you say that the level of our political exchange on a popular level is better or worse? Has it improved? Has it declined? I'm inviting you to criticize the evils of media, the advertising politician, the image, that yes. sort of thing. Draw some comparisons and contrasts for me in that sense.
Well, you know, you can compare and contrast on two levels, a level of performance, a level of capacity. We have no less capacity than Americans did in 1787. Do we perform at the level at which they performed then? Not generally. Sometimes we do. Not generally. Why do we not? Is it perhaps the case that we see the necessities with less urgency? After all, you don't found a republic every day. You know, it's a rare occasion. And when it happens, people are bound to be very much intensely involved in the activity, alert, thinking through all of the possibilities, wondering about the future. We say of ourselves often, we're too comfortable.
Yeah.
And we don't pay attention to things. Well, of course, when you inherit a fortune from your ancestors, there is a tendency to be more comfortable.
Now, one of our national editors, Lewis Lapham, has written a book describing the United States as a prodigal child. We have squandered an inheritance.
I disagree with it very strongly. Look, I travel all over this country. I talk about this Constitution to very ordinary people like myself. And it seems to me that the amazing thing is how profoundly interested in these arcane subjects the American people continue to be. I compare them with people I've known elsewhere in the world. And there is no comparison. Nowhere else do people take so seriously questions of fundamental purpose and structure of government. Oh, sure, they care in Europe about what party's in power, and they interpret that in pretty much directly interested terms. My party, I'm Labor, this is my party. When we're in, things are well. When we're out, things are not.
Right.
But the American thought goes far beyond that. We transcend political parties. That's why people like Professor Burns have trouble trying to turn us into mere class-oriented party politics people.
Right.
We think beyond that.
Are we unique politically?
Yes, quite unique. Look, the American experience, and the Anti-Federalists and Federalists really had a problem over this. It was an attempt to eliminate what I call social and political contradictions. The story of all politics theretofore is a story of class warfare, social political contradictions. The American founding set out to create a way of life that did not turn on that kind of class warfare. And to do that, one thing was needed. That was to convince the people themselves to pursue politics in a different way. We continue to do that. Nowhere else on the face of the earth is it done. Not even in Britain, which some people take to have been the nursery of our political institutions.
Is this what you would call what? Our inheritance, our legacy of federalism, the debate over federalism and anti-federalism?
The continual recurrence is our inheritance. One of my favorite tales is the fable in Aesop of the dying father who calls the sons around to his deathbed. And he says to them, boys, I want you to know there's a treasure buried in the vineyard.
Mm-hmm.
He dies and they put him away in decency. And then they take themselves to the garden and turn it up, every single inch of it. Never find a treasure. There is no trunk filled with jewels or anything. They are disappointed and they wonder, how could the old man do this to us? What kind of a joke is this to play when you're dying? Meanwhile, they put it out of their minds and went about their routine humdrum lives. But when harvest time came that year, they found they had the most bountiful harvest they had ever witnessed.
Because they'd gotten out there and dug all that and done all that digging, huh?
And the treasure we have inherited, far from being prodigals,
yeah.
And the whole debate over original intention, all that means is tilling the ground, because the responsibility is for us to do
uh-huh.
again and permanently in each generation what was done originally.
Uh-huh.
That's what the debate is about. You have to recur. That's what the treasure is.
Let me ask you to elaborate that point, Bill Allen, by way of conclusion. We're talking here about the Constitutional Convention, the Federalists, the Anti-Federalists. This reference that you just make about reading the Constitution, something that is written in granite, something that we should interpret in the light of our contemporary experiences. Help me with that a little bit. How do you approach that question?
I have one expression which has become a favorite for me to try to convey to people mm-hmm. how the Constitution was meant to be received by Americans then and now. And I think it's unvarying. I call it the Constitution to end all constitutions.
Right.
Now, what I mean by that is very simple. Throughout human history, we have known people to experience constitutions from the point of view of being subject to change. If this particular group is out of power, the way it gets into power is by overthrowing the Constitution and putting its own Constitution in place of the old one. And this still happens all over the earth. It's not just ancient history, it's modern history, except for us. Our Constitution was meant to internalize all political ambitions under an enduring constitutional form, so that never again would anyone have to pursue political ambition or power by overturning the Constitution. It is a final Constitution in that respect.
So you're telling me that we should look at it in the light, we should be sensitive to our history, but principally we should look at it in the light of our own contemporary needs and desires and wishes.
I'm telling you that it is written in such a way that we can have contemporarily, uh-huh. no legitimate desire, no legitimate need, which isn't accommodated by our Constitution.
Why is it then that there are people who are telling us that we need to get back into the minds of the founders and read our present day, our contemporary American society, in the light solely of what they were thinking about?
They're responding to people who tell you every time they want to accomplish something that you need a constitutional change.
Uh-huh.
They're saying, no, let's go back and rethink this entire enterprise, and we will see that the notion of self-government, which is enshrined in the Constitution, enables us to accomplish all legitimate ambitions
mm-hmm.
within the framework of the Constitution. When James Madison said on the floor of the convention that we are building a Constitution designed to last for ages, he didn't mean to say that we have answered every question anyone will ever raise. What he meant to say was we've made it possible for anyone to raise any conceivable question on a stable political foundation. And so we don't have to talk radical reformulations
mm-hmm.
in order to talk a future which is hopeful. That's what it's all about. And that's why I call it the Constitution to end all constitutions. The original intent debate is misunderstood by those who seem to imagine that by going back to the beginning, we can find prescriptions for particulars in our day. But I don't think any who are intelligent in that respect understand it that way. I take it that they are more concerned with what James Madison meant when he spoke of original intention, and which goes, therefore, in a far different direction than, say, Justice Brennan and his defenders would go today. They want to defend the notion of a transcendent principle above the Constitution,
right.
Something overarching, a higher law. That's good, in one sense, because after all, the Declaration of Independence is that transcendent principle.
Mm-hmm.
It is what inspires the Constitution and our understanding of Republican life. But what James Madison pointed out is that the Constitution must govern us, must govern even our taste at a certain level. And when he changed his mind on the National Bank, he opposed it originally in 1791. He said, it's unconstitutional. We never meant that mm-hmm. when we adopted the Constitution.
He did the same thing about having chaplains, did he not?
He did that. Well, that's a much more complicated question, but mm-hmm. yes, he wondered about that as well. Mm-hmm. However, he did recognize 20 years later when he approved the National Bank, the second bank of the United States, and he explained why. It was very interesting, the explanation he chose. He said, look, in 1791, I thought that we didn't mean to include a bank under the Constitution, but the very people who wrote, adopted, ratified the Constitution told me I was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
That was therefore the authoritative interpretation of the Constitution from the people who instituted it.
So it wasn't so much the intentions of the founders that formed the crux of this this issue as the response and the interpretation of the people who did the ratifying. And we are in a position today to continue that ratification.
Well, and Madison always from the beginning said the Constitution is not merely what the convention did.
Yeah.
It is the entire process that gives it legitimacy and produces the Constitution. So it includes the ratifying debates, it includes the debate over the Bill of Rights.
Mm-hmm.
It includes the action of that first generation, which did two things. First, adopt the Constitution. Secondly, adopt governmental processes under the Constitution.
Yeah.
Because you don't look at them as if they were a mind divided against itself.
Right.
They're one mind in both. And that's why James Madison became a defender of the National Bank later on.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that is a kind of original intent. And when we go back to that, you're right. We have to re-ratify the Constitution in each generation. And you know, that's not a metaphorical statement. That's really a statement that's, I think, fairly self-evident, fairly easy to understand.
It's very palpable for each generation. It has to be, otherwise you're out of touch
with it. Not only that, but of course, it only exists through us.
Yeah.
And if we are not re-ratifying it, it doesn't exist at all. They understood that.
Mm-hmm. William Allen is a professor of political science at Harvey Mudd College. He participated recently in the Tocqueville Forum, a public policy lecture series sponsored by Wake Forest University in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. For a cassette copy of Soundings on Federalism, Anti-Federalism, and the Bicentennial of the American Constitution, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings would like to hear from you. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, a conversation about the life and work of the Italian Renaissance painter Giovanni Bellini. My guest will be Rona Goffin, an art historian from Duke University. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Listen to Soundings. This is Kim Nielsen at the National Humanities Center inviting you to join Wayne Pond this week for a discussion about the Bicentennial of the American Constitution. Wayne's guest is William Allen of Harvey Mudd College. How did America's principal governing document come to exist? And who favored and opposed it at the time of its creation? American Federalism, some answers and insights this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.